From one islander to another, Isle of Wight Radio proudly presents John Hannam Meets.
Hi, and welcome to another John Hannam Meets archive. During my long career as a showbiz writer and broadcaster, I was lucky enough to interview Max Bygraves on two occasions. And today, we're going back to 1995, when I met him at Norton Grange on the Isle of Wight.
Another Hannam Archive.
He's been a star for, well, at least 45 years, and I'm so thrilled to say he's with me. Max, nice to see you again.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Is it that long, really? Good God.
When one looks back on your life, it's really amazing. I mean, you've had an incredible career.
Yes, it's sort of surprises me now and again. I'm writing a book at the moment called... at the moment it's called Fast Forward. I can't think of a better title because it happened quite by accident. I titled it Rewind, you know, the sort of thing you see on tape machines and video machines. And I thought that would be a good title of it. And one of my grandchildren came in and looked over my shoulder and said, "What are you doing, Granddad?" I said, "I'm writing a book." So he said, "That's a funny title, isn't it? Ruined." So I thought right away, I better change the title. So I changed it to Fast Forward.
Actually, you've flown into the Isle of Wight this time, Max.
Yes, I used the helicopter service from Bournemouth because coming from Bournemouth, it seems comparatively easy because I look out of my bedroom window and I'm looking at the Isle of Wight, you know, and then... You'd think that would be 10 minutes away, which it is by helicopter. But by the time you've gone up to one of the ferries, and by the time you aim to get one back again, you're looking at over a two-hour job. You have to sort of get from Bournemouth, get to the ferry, hope you're on time, don't have any waiting time, do the crossing, and then you have to get by car. A helicopter did it for me this morning in 12 minutes. Big difference, isn't it?
Incredible. Max, you've really earned your success. If you go back to the 30s, I think you actually lived in a one-bedroom council flat. Your family.
Two bedrooms. Was it? Yeah. Well, one bedroom, yes. You're quite right. Yeah, one living room, one. But we had beds in the living room. Yeah, we had a very tough beginning, but nothing more than what everybody else around that district, well, they were all in the same plight. You know, there was a depression on, there was unemployment everywhere. People had large families. I make quite a routine about it on the stage, telling the people how there was no such thing as the pill, you know, and the nearest thing they could get was Beecham's pills. You take six of those last thing at night, you're never in bed long enough for anything to happen, you know, that sort of thing. But that's joking, but in actual fact, it was a tough time. My father used to be on the dole because there was no work about, and... He used to get 28 shillings a week, and somehow my mother kept my father, her father, our grandfather, six kids, paid the rent, which was 8 and 4 pence a week. I'll never forget it because it made the same amount as 100 pennies, was 8 and 4 pence. You know? It was 8 and 4 pence a week, and when the landlord got it, if she didn't have it, then he would bang at the door all day, you know, and then that would be the end of it. But they were tough times, and really, I can't find too much to laugh about. I've made it into a funny routine, but when I look back, I can't. When I'm writing this book, I like to start in my teens because then, for me, life started happening. I went out into a wider world. And where we lived, it was almost a ghetto. For instance, a day out would be tuppence on a tram to Greenwich and then sort of enjoy the rolling sort of fields that were there. Or sometimes, we didn't have any money to spend on it, but sometimes they'd have a big, enormous fair there and you would have coconut shies and things like that. That was our idea of a holiday. So until I joined up, when I was 17 and a half, I hadn't seen the world at all, really. I'd seen the West End. I worked in the West End around the city of London, but I hadn't seen the world, not as I did when I got into the RAF and started going to different towns and different environments.
You'd actually been to the gods at the New Cross Empire, hadn't you?
Mm. Well, when I started earning a few pennies here and there, you know, like selling newspapers or chopping wood or something like that, I wasn't much interested in the cinema. I liked, unless it was musicals or something like that, but I liked the music hall. I liked the way that flesh and blood performers worked there and how they projected, and something fascinated me about them, so much so that I had already won a choir boy thing at Westminster Cathedral where I sang solo, and it got around that I was quite a nice kid singer. So if anybody was throwing a party, they used to say, invite young Wally. He always gives a song, you know, and then you go down. I'd learned two or three of the popular songs of the day, and provided you could start in the right key and finish in the right key, you would, the people would go round and say, yeah, so they give you a few coppers here and there. And if that happened on a Saturday night, a penny here and tuppence there, you'd wake up on Sunday morning to go to church. I was at the Catholic Church at Paradise Street in Rotherhithe, and you'd feel affluent, you know, you'd drop a few coppers of it into the collection, but I'd hold it up high for everybody to see that you've put it in the book plate, you know. But that's how it was.
You also won a talent contest, I think, when you were quite young. Do you remember what you sang?
Yeah, well, when I went in for this talent competition at New Cross Empire, it was you know, I go as you please, do anything, and I got right up to the finals, and I thought, well, it's going to be packed. I mean, most of the time it was sort of half packed and half full at the theatre, but come the Saturday night, everybody was there, your parents and everybody, you thought, well, what could I do that's different? Everybody was in nice suits and beautiful dresses. And I didn't have any nice suits or beautiful. I was about 12 years old at that time. And what I did was to get a sort of my father's working cap, a pair of long trousers that I turned up, and then billed myself as a sort of a Jackie Coogan, who was all the rage at that time with Charlie Chaplin. And I sang a song called "It's My Mother's Birthday Today," and I took a dog on with me. And when I finished the song, the compere, it was a man named Tony Gerrard. He came out, and for the six finalists, he held the hands above the head, and they went by applause. And the audience were aware that they wanted to make a winner of somebody, and they went for me, and I got wonderful. Beautiful applause, and I got £25, and it doesn't sound a lot nowadays, but my father, he would have had to work for the best part of about 10 weeks to have earned that. His money in those days was only about £2.50 a week, and he and mine making it in one evening, so it didn't take long to work out that show business would be a good idea.
Mm. I know you sort of entertained in the RAF, but you sort of came out and got into the business, and you worked with people like Frankie Howard initially,
yeah,
didn't you?
Yeah. We started together in the business. We met at the BBC. He was doing an audition. He was very, very nervous, and I thought, oh God, if I ever got as nervous as that, I'd pack the business up. It was a sort of a discovery program. It was a program for people coming out of the RAF or the Army or the Navy. And if they entertained, the BBC was quite willing to give them a chance. And it started a new wave of comedy. There were many, many people started off like that. The ones that survived were people like Dennis Dorden and Frank Muir and Spike Milligan and Harry Secombe. Benny Hill went in later. He didn't go in the war. He went in for his national service. And there was Eric Sykes and Frankie Howard. We'd all come out in the forces, and we started a new sort of era. All the sort of staple comics, we were leaving them behind because we had fresh ideas, new ideas. We tried to do as best we could, and we sort of ousted the older generation. And well, that's what it is today. We were still around.
It's great. He's got a swell personality. He meets and greets the stars with such amenity. Good enough to make you coming out of the street. John Hannamade. That's right.
My current guest is a real legend. We hear people called legends these days, and they've only really been in the business a few years, but my guest today has been in the business 50 years. He's been a star for 45. The incredible Max Bygraves. Max, you made lots of movies too, bless them all. Was it Skimpy in the Navy?
Yeah, they were sort of shake-ups. They were made in a week. They were...
were they?
Yeah. And they were sort of done as fillers to go on with the big attraction, but out of it came a lot of good, because you learned a movie technique. But my first love was the theatre, and if anybody ever wanted me for a movie, they always want you tomorrow. And I had bookings galore. We've come to a part of my career now where I've been in the business over 50 years. And I can't remember having more than a fortnight off ever. I've worked all my life at either in a theatre or in television, or I can't remember having any longer than that. Maybe I have. I'm sure I have, but I can't think of it offhand.
You went on to bigger movies like Crive in the Streets. Do you remember that?
That was a good film. That, yeah, that was made by. A director that later on started making all the James Bond films. That was Lewis Gilbert. And I admired Lewis Gilbert because I'd made films before, but never ever got... They call themselves directors, but you very rarely get direction. I mean, my idea of a good director is somebody that takes you in the corner and says, now, look, you're coming in the house now. What has gone before you is that a girl has been murdered, which was Cry from the Street was, you know. Now... You've got to go over there because she's left three children, and suddenly you're involved with these children. Now you go in, and as you come in the door, this is the biggest surprise of your life. So really, when you see the girl sort of, and you can't revive her in bed, really look anxious, really think, what am I going to do with these children? How am I going to tell them? That is good direction. You know, that just putting you in the picture for that. So every scene was like that. Now, a lot of directors just let you get on with it. You read the part and you hope that what you're doing captures, you know, what they... You see, you go into a film and you see an early John Wayne or James Stewart or Henry Fonda. So some of those early films, they were disgraceful in them, but they had a little bit of charisma. But they weren't great actors. I'm sure they had to do what a lot of us are doing nowadays, even. Like, you look at video and you think to yourself, well, I like what I'm doing there, but I don't like that. I'll take that out. I won't work like that again. I'll do this and I'll do that because that's good. That's my good side. I'll project better. I talk too loud here. There's all these little things. And I'm sure that people like I just mentioned, they must come into a cinema... When in the 30s, you know, when they were coming up as stars, I think they must have said what I'm saying now. Like, they sat in the cinema, sat in the back, probably crept in the cinema to see where what they were doing right and what they were doing wrong. And out of it came great sort of personality and everything. That's the only way they could have learned, because you can see so many... I saw a film the other day called Darby Gill and the Little People. And Sean Connery, who's a friend of mine, and he was on, and he was a glamour boy. His hair was quiffed. it was shiny and black, and he couldn't stop smiling. He was trying to get over this. I mean, when you see Sean nowadays, Sean just smiles with his eyes. He doesn't. He never. You hardly ever see his teeth. He. But in this one, when he was a young star in the 50s, he was putting on the glamour, and it didn't suit him one bit. You thought, he looked good, but he was trying to look better.
Max, you were a wonderful stand-up comedian with wonderful catchphrases like "Big Ed" and "Good Idea, Son." They were sort of national institutions, really, weren't they?
Yeah, you can't plan them, you know. I mean, something, it happens. Like I was watching The Night Bruce Forsyth said, I'm in charge, you know. It was quite a harmless, and most of my lines came out of things we never intended them to be catchphrases, but Eric Sykes, who used to write the scripts, had a quick ear for anybody that was doing a line, you know, and not aware that it was going to be a very, very funny line. As soon as he heard something, some little bit of magic in a line, like, as soon as I rushed on and said, I've arrived and to prove it, I'm here, you know, and it was only because I mimicked Archie Andrews, you know. He would say, now we go down the road, Mr. Bargraves, and I'll come down there, and then I'll say, and I used to do the line exactly as he just read it. He said, and I'd say, a good idea, son. And out of that was built this, I mean, just breaking the, it should have been a good idea, son. You know, that's how it should have been spoken.
Educating Archie was a wonderful stepping stone for you, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah. It was good. They were wonderful scripts, Eric Sykes. And, of course, the people that were in it have proven themselves that they are absolutely wonderful people. Julie Andrews was our singer in it. Beryl Reid was in it. Tony Hancock was in it. There was Peter himself. We had the Headley Water, the Tanner sisters. Now, you see the Tanner sisters, or one of them, turn up regularly in great dramatic parts. You know, the talent was always there. And later on, we had people like Gilbert Harding, and it was just wonderful to be with these people, because although they were new and we were all new names, the potential was there. They had the quality. It had to be nursed and it had to be made better.
The last count, I think, was 19 Royal Varieties, or have you?
Yeah, done 19 Royal shows, yeah.
What an incredible achievement. Any real fond memories of those shows, Max?
Well, I think every I did a show the other night where I did some Bud Flanagan songs, and they asked me if I had any memories of Bud Flanagan. And the one that stands out in my memory was a command performance we did in 1951. It was with King George VI, and Frankie Howard was just eating his fingers with nerves, you know. And Bud Flanagan took him aside. He said, now listen, son, don't be nervous. He said, you're here because you're the best there is. If there was anybody better, they would be on here and you would be outside looking for work now. So just go on, do your best. And he goes on there in the first half, and he was a riot. He was great. He was wonderful. They loved him. And then it was interval, and we all went over to the little pub on the corner. We came back to get ready for the finale, and in the dressing room there was a singing act from America called the Merry Max. And the leader, he was like Frank. He was like, you know, eating his fingers and trying to guess how they would go or whether they would be all right. And I saw Frank with him in the corner with his arm round his shoulder. He said, now listen, you're here because you're the best there is. If there was anybody better. He's just passing on Bud Flanagan's advice. And it was a lovely moment. I thought, yeah, you're all right now, you've been on.
What about the other catchphrase? Was it big money? Something like that.
Oh, yeah, I did that on Family Fortunes, yeah. I didn't like Family Fortunes. I didn't work well in that. It wasn't my cup of tea. I'm a sort of a solo performer, you know. I can't. They thought it was a good idea, and it did well, and it was in the top, and we got great ratings, and they paid me a lot of money. But I sort of let it be known that I'd be rather happier out of it, and I got out of it gracefully.
You can't beat Sunday afternoon sitting down, listening to the radio, and listening to John Hannam talk to the stars. He knows them all, you know. I love White Radio.
My current guest is Max Bygraves. We're talking about his incredible career. Max, you've had 31 gold discs, 15 silver, and 3 platinum.
Yeah, marvellous, isn't it? As I tell everybody on the stage, I've been in the business 50 years. I've been married to the same girl and still enjoying it 50 years. And I said, and we've just paid the 50th installment on our washing machines.
Max, a lot of younger people take the mickey out of some of the older stars. I mean, there was a wonderful gag where a burglar went to somewhere and stole some records and in the dark, found over yours and took them back. But
yeah, that's been amplified a bit. But it did happen to an old people's home. They stole all the LPs and the tapes, and then mine. No, you've got the story mixed up now. It was Des O'Connor.
But, I mean, you've sold so many records.
Yeah, millions.
Singing has been a great part of your career, hasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, really? Yeah. I didn't start out as a singer. I mean, I just got lucky with doing a thing that the public latched on to, because nobody was looking after that sort of, that side of the record business. They were kept making records for the young ones, and they thought that people like us, you know, didn't exist. And I started making songs full of melody, which was really lacking at the early 70s. Everybody was concentrating on the Tom Jones or the groups or things, and this side of the market was very empty. And I started doing it only through my poor old mum, who loved music but never really got a chance to listen to the music she liked, because nobody was playing it. And I made a tape for her, and the head of the Pi Records heard it. He said, "This is not bad. Why don't we bring a record out like that?" And I made a record with a choir and with a group of musicians. And the rest is history. It took off like wildfire, and we're still selling thousands of records.
You've also written a novel called Milkman's on His Way.
That's right. Yeah. Mm. I heard that at a book launching party when they decided to launch my book, and somebody, I don't know who it was, I can't think of his name, but he said, "Oh, it's all right to write an autobiography, you know, it's easy. Try writing a novel." And that irked me. I tried to think, well, could I write a novel? And I sat down and wrote The Milkman's on His Way. At one time, they were making a film of it, you know, but that fizzled out, and because nobody's ever got any money now in England to make films. But maybe the idea's a little bit hackneyed now. It was about a milkman that wins Opportunity Knocks, and from a non-entity, he becomes very famous, and he finds that it's harder to get out of show business than to get in it, because so many people were making money and living off him, you know, that they didn't want him out of it, and they made it so as he couldn't get out, because, as I say, they were all making millions out of him.
Max, before you go, any regrets looking back on a wonderful career?
Yes, I have one regret, actually. Just before he died, Alfred Hitchcock saw one of my pictures in America, and he was making his last film then, a film called Frenzy, and he wanted me to play the lead in it. And he came over, we had chats. I sat with him for about 3 hours in 139 Piccadilly, and we should have made it, but I had so many commitments. One of the big ones was I was working at a place called the Golden Garter in Manchester, just off Manchester Airport, and I couldn't get out of the contract. They had already sold, you know, lots of seats, and it was the very time when Alfred Hitchcock and his schedule would have been filming down in Covent Garden. So I lost the part because of that. But what I like is that he saw some little bit of magic in me that decided he'd like me to play the part of that, you know, that leading part in Frenzy, and I lost it.
Max Brygace, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you.
You've been in the business 50 years. You're a credit to the business, still working well, still drawing big houses. Wonderful.
Thank you.
Well, that was super smashing great, wasn't it? Jim Bourne here, just reminding you, you've been listening to John Hannam.
That was recorded at Norton Grange, Warner's Holiday Centre at Yarmouth on the Isle of Wight. Something amazing happened that night. I was at the show and Max just walked on stage and everyone in the 500 audience stood up. He did nothing. They just stood up and cheered. And I thought, that's a superstar for you. And just to make it a wonderful day for me, just before I left Max later in the evening, he said to me, "John, I listen to your show sometimes in Bournemouth because it's just across from the Isle of Wight." I couldn't believe it. One of the great moments of my life. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye for now.
Sweet man. Oh. Who was he again, dear?
John.
John.
Yes.
Yes, John.
Just John.
Hannum, was it?
Yes.
Yes.
I think so.
Yes. What does he do?
He talks to people like you and me, dear.
Oh, I see.